Well, I wrote in the premium newsletter this week, looking ahead to the interview that we're going to have in a moment with Glenn Osmond, who's the former CEO of Comair and the author of Crash and Burn. Let me show you that right up front. There it is. That's what it looks like. I wrote that I get so many bad books. And years ago, I took a decision that I would dump them. If they weren't good enough, they would be gone into file 13, and often you'd get the publicist phone you and ask you, oh, are you going to do anything on this? Do you want to talk to the author? And my response is to try and avoid the call, or then if I have to get pushed into a corner, say, well, a very wise person once told me, if you can't say something nice about it, just shut up. And when it comes to writing a book, having written a couple myself, I know that it's an enormous labor. It takes a heck of a long time. So even though some people are, they should stay far, far away from a keyboard, and they certainly should stay far away from publishers, and they have put a lot of effort into it. So I don't want to be nasty. But this book, man, Glenn Osmond, I loved it. I was riveted. You must know, reading your book has to compete in my life with Road to Serfdom by Hayek, or any other great book that I've got there on a very long list of to read. And in this case, though, it was fabulous. But let's start your story where in the beginning of where you start the book, which is in the old homeland of Bophuthatswana, 1989. You're an accountant, not a person who went off into the airline industry because you were a pilot or obsessed about it. You're one of the guys who shouldn't have gone there, according to Warren Buffett, because he reckons, very famously, that if there'd been a capitalist at Kitty Hawk in 1903, when the Wright brothers had their first flight, he would have taken out a revolver and shot both of them, because very few industries have destroyed shareholder value to the degree that airlines have. And yet, you arrived there and, well, spent, as your book tells us, decades having a lot of fun, meeting some really crazy people, and quite a few miscreants amongst them. But what, just maybe unpack from the start why an accountant, which is a respectable career, would go into something like airlines.
It really was a chance encounter. You know, there was no dream of working for an airline. I've never been passionate about aircraft. In fact, flying is quite excruciating, to tell the truth. It was purely a chance encounter. I completed my articles at Price Waterhouse. I was in Mafeking. I needed something to do. I went to Abraham, met a guy who was CEO of the local airline, and his CFO had just left and moved across to Comair. It's a very incestuous industry. And he asked me, would I be interested? And I said, yeah, it sounds good. And in those days, you were hired without a psychometric test or without HR involvement or recruitment agencies. And I started a month or two later. So I started in airlines purely by chance. And once I was in it, I really just stayed in it. It's almost like you need to stick to what you know. And the more I stayed in it, I sort of became more of a specialist only in that thing. I was probably unemployable outside the industry. So I really just stuck in the industry for over 30 years.
You mentioned Comair. That features very prominently in your book. But the one part of it that I was really interested in, having watched and written and broadcast on the sector for so long, is that it's a bit of a club, airlines. It's not often that the real story comes out. And that's, I suppose, why I found your book so fascinating. We as journalists, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. We get some of the pieces that come from public statements, but a lot of the pieces are missing. And your book is certainly bad at a heck of a lot of pieces. For instance, the whole disaster of Comair. But let's just go back a little bit. You met the Noviks, the Novik family, Dave Novik, the late Dave Novik, and his son, Gideon, who's very highly exposed in South Africa. You kind of had a mixed reading through the book, a mixed assessment of them. And on the one hand, you really admired Dave. On the other hand, I got the feeling that you and Gideon didn't really sit comfortably around the same boardroom table.
It was a great company. If you look at Dave Novick, he started in the 1960s. I think he left in about 2010. And for his full career, they made a profit every year, coming. And really, it was the three of them. It was Dave Novick as chairman, Martin Moritz, who was worked as a Comi deputy chairman, and Piet van Werven as the CEO. And the strength lay from the three of them working together combined. Their skills weren't the same, their personalities were different, and they formed a really formidable team. And it was that team that drove the business for the 40-odd years that they made these consistent profits. So it's not really just an individual, but the steel backbone of the business in a way was probably Dave Novick. He's the chairman and accountant as well. And I learned a lot from Dave. I have a high regard for Dave. I respect Dave, and I learned a lot from Dave. We obviously had a fallout at one point, mainly because of I incurred a foreign currency loss, which I shouldn't have. And then after that, I'd left and started OneTown. So that put the relationship under a strain. But what's really gratifying, probably about 20 years after I left, when I returned to Comi, and Dave Novick had already left 10 years earlier, he called me when my appointment was announced as CEO, and he wished me luck. He said it was the right thing for the airline to hire me, and I was the right guy to fix the airline. So I found it quite gratifying that when I was at OneTown, we fought each other to the death. I mean, we just fought every day, every imaginable area we fought in the market, in the press, operationally, fighting for skills and people. So it was really a tough fight. But at the end of it, 10 years later, he wished me well for the future. So, that was really gratifying for me. The son, myself and Gideon, he wished me well on the book. He sent me congratulations. We chat now and again. So I like to believe I have no enemies in the industry. There are times when we fought and there are times we worked together.
So why is it so confrontational in the business sense?
I suppose if you look at the personalities involved, if you take who was running Comi, who was running Nationwide, if you take the actual people and you take their personalities, that's really what drives how these businesses were run and how the businesses were conducted and the approach to competition and matters like that. When I left Comi and started OneTown, it seemed to cross a line, though. It was no longer, let's just compete in the market fiercely. And some lines were crossed at the time. I talk about dirty tricks that happened at the time. So at some point it became personal, but in fact, not probably for 8 years it was personal. We said Comi, we never went to work, we went to war. We fought every day, knowing that there's this huge airline next door to us, market dominant, who has a sole objective of putting us out of business. So those years were a lot of fun, definitely the most exciting part of my career.
A lot of the book does refer to South African Airways as well. But the part that kind of opened my eyes was right in the early stages. You talk of an example of somebody who left SAA, went to Comi, gave across information that was confidential, and then was found out, was caught. And the ethics, as you say, was the problem was that it wasn't that we did it, it was that we were caught that seemed to be the problem at Comi. And if you look at that, you're going way back to 1998 and the listing, etc., where the founders banked a lot of money. They banked 300 million rands, which is 1.2 billion rand in today's terms. So they were set up for life almost. So from there onwards, it was an interesting contrast. Here you had these very wealthy people running an airline against a state airline that maybe certainly wasn't as efficient, but was being subsidized by the state, by the government, as we know, massive, massive bailouts. It almost seems like an impossible journey. And yet you guys had fun.
Yeah. One of the themes in the book, there are a few themes I'd like to think. The one theme is what made Comi great and what caused the fall? What was the root cause of the failure? And we are talk about these things is just to show that the world in the 90s was very different to the world now in terms of business ethics, in terms of HR departments, in terms of regulation, and in terms of competition. So the world in the 90s was a lot tougher than it is now, you know, in terms of the environment in which you operate. When I say tough, a lot less regulated than it is the environment in which you operate now. So I talk about that only as, if you look at the ethics, the sentiment was, we've been caught out. It wasn't, we shouldn't have done this, which is really the point I was trying to make, which is one of the ethics. It's just an anecdote about trying to put across, well, these are the ethics that prevailed in the industry at the time. And at the same time, I was part of it. So, you know, there's no way I can go and throw stones and say, these were the bad guys and I was the good guy. That's how business was conducted in the 90s.
And who were the good guys? Or were there any good guys in this whole play?
No, of course, of course. I think it's like any other industry. There's as many good guys and bad guys. And the ones who succeed are a mixture of the good and the bad guys. So, and it's also a question of perception. So I don't think it's unique to any other industry in terms of the bad guys and the good guys.
What is interesting, though, is that there was this driving by the then dominant player, and it appears to be the same thing now with Safair, to put everybody else out of business by cutting costs. It's a really dumb strategy when you consider the longevity of business, because you put them out of business, someone else is definitely going to come back in, as has happened time and again in airlines. Why did the penny not drop for anyone that it really isn't the right approach, or might there have been something else that was driving it?
Yeah, when I talk about controlling costs, it's not really chopping it's not chopping costs that you need to incur. It's becoming more efficient. So in other words, if we raise our pilot productivity, that lowers our costs. So we are talk about important to have lower costs. It's really about being the most efficient things in terms of how you structure your balance sheet.
I'm talking about the pricing. I'm talking about
predatory pricing.
And it's almost like in the airline industry, first of all, you had SAA, predatory pricing, to put Comair out of business, and then we'd have everything, and then we would be profitable. But if Comair had gone, someone else would have come in. And now we've got the same with Safair, predatory pricing, very low costs. What's going on in the heads of the executives that they really believe that if we put these guys out of business, it'll be a bigger market for us, without understanding that in the market, you're just going to bring in another competitor?
That's exactly right. It's always temporary, and it's always someone else's fault. You seldom get to agree that the price, you started the price war. So price wars are part of the business. They're always happening. You can ask three guys engaged in the price war, and all three will accuse the other of having started the war, and they are simply the victims responding. But it is a consistent strategy. Let's drop prices in the hope of forcing someone out of business, in the hope of growing our market share. If not just dropping prices, let's just force people out of business in the hope of growing our market share and growing our prices, which is really a theme throughout the book.
And it's not just South Africa. It seems to be an international approach, which is, again, why Warren Buffett is so says that it's the graveyard for capitalism.
Yeah, look, there have been success stories in aviation. If you take Comair, that was a success story for 70-odd years. So there are success stories, but the graveyard way outstrips the number of success stories in South Africa particularly. I'd imagine in the last 20-odd years, there's probably been over 20 airline failures in South Africa.
So is there one that is going to be a success? In other words, if you were to consult to an airline today, how would you recommend that they go forward so that they will be that rarity in a sector which is very difficult to make money in?
So I'm an accountant and I focus on the income statement, and I talk about the three critical success factors for an airline to succeed. And really, it's you must have lower operating costs than your competitors. In other words, be more efficient in how you do things. Secondly, focus on cash. Always focus on cash. Whatever you do, grow the cash, because those external shocks are going to come, and so many of the failures are just who was last man standing. So airlines fall by the wayside when they run out of cash. And it's such a fine margin. If you look at Comair, what would be a 6-7 billion rand company, in the end, the problem on cash was 100 million and we would have traded out of that within 2 months probably. So focus on cost, focus on cash, and really avoid excessive debt. The mistake a lot of the airlines doing is saying, we need to fly the newest and the latest aircraft. It's wonderful. They're fuel efficient. They're wonderful aircraft. But you're taking on all this debt. So simplistically, low costs, grow cash, and avoid debt. And you avoid debt really by flying older aircraft, not the newest aircraft. In South Africa, earning rands, you can never afford new US dollar aircraft. It's just not possible because the rand is depreciating every year by the inflation differential. There's shocks on the currency, and you really can't afford to earn rands and try and pay off huge US dollar debts.
Why did Comair not resuscitate, given that it had been going for 70 years, it had a great brand, and yet when it died, it died?
Yeah, which is really the title, Crash and Burn, is a Sudden Collapse. So it was a sudden collapse. You know, they were operating, got hit by COVID, went into business rescue and never emerged from business rescue. So I talk about, well, what was the root cause that led to this successful business having a sudden and immediate crash? And it also would be convenient to blame COVID. It would be convenient to blame the civil aviation who grounded the airline. But ultimately, SAFE and Airlink survived groundings from the CA. They survived the same COVID shocks, the same fuel price shocks. So operating in exactly the same environment with the same external shocks, why did some survive and some collapse? And that's really the root cause of Comair's failure, which is this issue around you have to control costs, you have to protect cash, and you have to avoid debt. Now, when they took the decision to buy the MAX aircraft, it effectively wiped out all three, because you take the MAX aircraft, immediately you add to cost. It erodes all your cash. You take the cash stockpile that they'd built up over 10 years, a billion rand, and you, it's aircraft deposits. And now you've got no deposits. You got no cash. And now you've got massive debt. So simultaneously, those three core principles are wiped out. And then, mixed with that is you've got a business that's lost control of costs just overall. Their break-even load factor was 86% when I joined. So they needed to sell 86% of all their seats just to break even, which is impossible. Very few airlines can sustain a load factor above 80%. So their business model had built-in losses. You then add to that inertia. The organization had grown fat and lazy. The management inertia. No decisions were taken, and it was just this lumbering airline that Air Link and SAFE were just taking market share from them every day. And their solution was to take on more debt to fund the operating losses. So it was really that spiral that started prior to COVID.
And South African Airways, their demise or decline, but the ability to come out of business rescue in contrast to Comair.
Yeah, what the weakness in business rescue is that it's not like Chapter 11 in America. Chapter 11 in America is perfect because the company stays under control of management. You just restructure your cost base. And anyone who doesn't like it, you're allowed to cancel the contracts. The flaw in South African business rescue is that you're allowed to cancel foreign contracts, but the foreign entities don't recognize the South African business rescue process. So in South African business rescue, if all your suppliers are South African-based, perfect. But all our big suppliers were all foreign-based. So we weren't able to achieve any reduction. In fact, they squeezed us for more and more in business rescue. So the aircraft leases, we took a hammering. Sabre, which was all our technology, we took a hammering. Aircraft maintenance, we took a hammering. So all these huge costs, we weren't able to reduce them at all. Because the foreign guys just said, well, we don't recognize South African business rescue. So that's really the one flaw. The other flaw in South African business rescue is that the business control is taken away from management and the board, and it's vested in the business rescue practitioners. And practitioners are generally have, they're from the industry of the liquidators. You know, it's sort of, they normally specialize in business rescue liquidation. And Their main fear in life is being sued, that either a creditor is going to sue them or a shareholder is going to sue them for a business rescue decision they take. So they hire an army of lawyers. So suddenly your legal fees rocket. Lawyers are making the calls. So if you just look at it overall, essentially in business rescue, you can't reduce your foreign costs and you've got lawyers running the show. And that's why it doesn't really work like it does in America under Chapter 11.
I also was fascinated by the brinkmanship that was played by the creditors of ComEd. Just unpack that for us, because it's almost like you know you're going to lose more if they go bust, but I'm going to push the envelope anyway.
Yeah, it applied to every stakeholder, not just the creditor. The sad thing is ComEd could have been saved because it didn't need cash, it needed time. So when I say it didn't need cash, it had a cash shortfall, which was at the ultimate lowest season in the year, which is May. So at the end of May is when your sales are the lowest, and it really is always a really tough month. So end of May happens and we have a shortfall. We know we can trade out of it because the season picks up in July, August, September. So we needed like probably 2-3 months to say, look, we can trade out of this. We just need some breathing space. And it needed to come from all the stakeholders, just a little bit. Something from lessors, something from the South African Airports Company, AT&S, something from the regulatory authorities, something from the staff and the trade unions, something from the banks. And we tried asking them all just for a little bit because we didn't need a lot. It was 120 million, which is tiny compared to what they would have lost if the business stopped trading. And I've always had this view that sanity will prevail in life, but this time sanity didn't prevail. And not a single of those 5 or 6 stakeholders was willing to budge an inch. They all took the view that this is not our problem, this is someone else's problem, please go away. And in the end, it was everyone's problem, and they all ended up worse off than they are now.
And the role of the banks?
Yeah, look, one of the flaws in the rescue plan was the obligations to the banks were really onerous in terms of interest rates. Unfortunately, the banks had taken a view when the rescue plan had been developed that they weren't really hard up for a rescue. You know, they believed they had value in the aircraft, they had equity, and they really could walk away from the deal if need be. So we were always on the back foot in trying to negotiate a deal. So they hit us with horrendous interest rates, and they really squeezed us on the repayment terms in terms of what we had the debt, you know, where they shortened the terms instead of extending the terms. So that was really a squeeze on us on interest rates and even fees. We had to pay a lot of fees to the banks and so forth. And those numbers were really substantial. But at the time, the banks had taken a view that, or they'd be happy to walk away from it. So that really wasn't great. It was one of the weaknesses in the rescue plan that I have spoken about as well.
There's so much to learn from your experience, so much that people reading this book will say is wrong with the system, the banks on the one hand, the business rescue practitioners on the others, the introduction of lawyers, the exclusion of management. How the heck are you supposed to trade out of a difficult situation if you're bringing in amateurs to run the show? But when you look back on it all and you look back on the career, any regrets that you actually went off to go and join that airline straight from school and perhaps not stay in the accounting profession?
Oh, no, I have absolutely no regrets. I've enjoyed all of it. There's been lows and highs, fortunately more highs than lows, more successes than failures. So I've enjoyed it. And the alternative, staying in auditing, no, I don't think I would have made a great auditor. Those audit files used to kill me. So no, I have absolutely no regrets. It's been a great career. I'm young, so it's not over yet. And yes, I have absolutely no regrets. I've learned lessons, hopefully just enough time still to apply those lessons learned. So let's see.
What is next for you?
Oh, no, I need to stay in the industry. And, you know, there are opportunities. There's always an opportunity for a new entrant. If you look at Safair now, they're market dominant. I think they're 60% of the market share. There's a real opportunity, I'd say, for a new entrant. And not necessarily that I'll be involved, but I think there will be a new entrant. I think SAA will be okay. They seem to be doing the right things. So I think the market will end up with SAA probably as the premium carrier, Safair as the low-cost carrier, and probably Air Link providing all the regional services. So that seems to be where the market is now, but it needs a new entrant. It's not healthy having Safair having 60% market share.
And when you say that it was a great career and you enjoyed it, when I read your book, a lot of the work you had to do was fix things. And when you fix things, you start fighting with people. The pilots don't come out very well in your book, and you can maybe elaborate a little on that. But when you go into retrenching staff and getting people to cut, it's not an easy task. How did you approach that?
Yeah, it's not easy, but I've always taken the view. So when I had to fix the aircraft maintenance company, they were losing 70 million and we had 700 staff. And I went in there and I had to retrench half. But so I retrenched 350 people, but in order to save, you know, that saved the 350 jobs. So it's, for myself, I always say I need to do it to save the jobs. So same at Comair, you know, there were 2,200 staff. We operated a business of similar size with 1,200 staff. I still ask myself, what were those 1,000 doing? I don't even know what those 1,000 were doing. Same with the maintenance company. We went from 700 to 350, same revenue, and we turned it from a loss to a profit. So it's almost like in order to secure jobs, I need to do that. Unfortunately, the trade unions aren't much help. The trade unions, in my experience, have never saved a single job. They've never created a single job. They're really in the business of probably destroying jobs, I think. So that hasn't been positive. But the environment, I agree with you, is not easy. When you're in a hostile environment, you need to retrench people. Or you're in a hostile environment, you're telling the partners they need to work harder. But it's something that you need to do in order to create a sustainable business. And the message to the staff was always, we need a sustainable business to protect your jobs. So we need to do these things to create sustainable business. And I'd hammer that home. But the unions just never saw that I was trying to achieve that, you know. The trade unions are... You're trying to create profits on our sweat and our blood. You're saying, no, we're not. We're trying to create a sustainable business. If you're earning 40% more than the market is earning for the same job, we have to have a look at your salary levels. But that message is not easy to get across to the unions.
Yeah, that old story is, if you think that education is expensive, try ignorance. The pilots... they, as I mentioned, they didn't come out terribly well in your book. They appear to be this royal game of the airline industry, or certainly were at some point in time. Is that changing? Is there more reality now?
Yeah, it seems to go through cycles, but they're extremely powerful at Comair, the pilot body. Somehow they've managed to negotiate themselves their working conditions. And generally, it was always the lifestyle trumped the operational requirements of the company. And when I started the second stint, you know, the pilots at Comair were on average flying 60 hours a month, while Safairs were flying 85 hours a month. And then the Comair pilots were earning 30-40% more than the Safair pilots. So once you combine that, our productivity was less than half of Safair's. So you have to have that fight. You have to get the headcount down and the productivity up. Obviously, that creates resentment amongst the pilot body. So I have taken a hammering there, particularly on the social media. I've really been hammered. I think I was called the second most hated person in aviation. The most hated was probably Didumayena, I think. So evidently, I was ranked below that. So I have taken a hammering on the pilot websites, but... it had to be done. You know, there is no way you can afford to have your productivity for pilots at half of Safair's when it's probably 60% of your staff cost bill. So there are unions. There's NUMSA, Solidarity, and the Pilot Union. But effectively, they're all after the same thing. You know, let's more pay, less work. The pilots, obviously, are more sophisticated in terms of safety and things like that. But generally, that's a fight you have to fight. It's not unique to South Africa. It's not unique to Comair. It wasn't unique to me. So it's an age-old sort of battle between management and pilots. In the UK or in Europe, they've made a lot of progress with Ryanair, for example. So they've achieved what needs to be achieved. But a lot of the legacy airlines still have these problems. This whole think of the pilots being a special body or something like that. Yeah,
it's so interesting when you look at it with the benefit of hindsight. Those pilots would surely have thought differently had they known that there wouldn't have been a Com Air anymore, because presumably they're ending up at SAF Air anyway, where they're going to have to work harder for less pay.
That's 100% correct, Ali. Exactly what happened. They ended up at SAF Air, flying the 85 hours and taking the 30% salary knock. Yet when we were pleading them to take a salary freeze for a period of time and marginally increase productivity, they were not interested.
Glenn, just to end off with, you said you are called the second most hated person in aviation. Well, we know Dudu Mieni is probably in a league of her own, but does it trouble you that, and why might that be?
No, look, I think it was just a great opening line for the book review. It really doesn't trouble me, and I truly believe it's not true. I've really tried to act ethically in what I've done throughout my career. I've said I've never studied leadership. I've no idea on what the appropriate leadership styles are, but I try to stay true to myself, true to my values, and I try and do things that way. So I'm sure I'm not the second most hated at all. But in airlines, you have to make the hard calls, like any business. If you need to make the hard call on headcount, you need to make the hard call on costs, and you need to make those calls. And obviously, it's not going to make you the most popular guy around.
You need to make those calls in pretty much every business, but it just seems that in airlines, it's more difficult for some reason. Why might that be?
I think what makes airlines probably slightly different is the safety. Safety can never be compromised. And there's this false perception that airlines are safe because the civil aviation keeps them safe. You know, the civil aviation have no impact on safety. Airlines regulate their own safety because it's good business to be safe. You can't afford to have incidents that are unsafe, so you invest heavily in safety. But yet there's often this thing that if an airline's bringing down costs, they're compromising on safety. So it probably makes that association, or is often made, which is really totally incorrect. There is absolutely no link between costs and negatively impacting safety. I've never been aware of a single call the airlines ever had to make on, well, let's save this cost, even though it might have a negative impact. So safety is always sacrosanct. Safety is always on top of it. And in fact, airlines will always make the call the other way around. You know, let's rather cancel flights. So safety is sacrosanct, but yet there's this association between if you're saving costs, safety might be impacted.
Now, you can understand that. Nobody will be that idiotic to say that we'll take a chance. Maybe we will have something falling out of the sky, because that's the end of the game. And from your side, it's not the end of the game, as you've explained to us, but maybe give us some insider tips. When you fly, do you fly at a certain time of day or certain day of the week, and not just locally but internationally? Are there, from the, and again, putting your accountant hat on, the best value that one can get?
Well, I really don't have many insider tips. I prefer flying to Europe during the day than the evening, if possible at all, because I struggle to sleep on the flights. But that's some advice. Flying locally, I try to avoid SAF Air. I try and find anyone else, you know, just because of the superior service and the improved product. Sometimes it's not worth saving the $100 and sacrificing legroom or sacrificing something else. So I try and avoid some low-cost airlines, and traveling to Europe, I'd rather fly during the day than the evening. But I have no other tips at all.
But why, Glenn, are there so few flights during the day? I'm in your camp absolutely on that one. I'd rather arrive there in the evening and have a good night's sleep than, as most people do, struggle to sleep overnight on the airlines. Why is it? Is there a landing obligation on the airlines that fewer flights are available in the day?
No, what my sense of it is, the airlines flying to Europe, they make their really big money flying the business class. It's not the people sitting at the back in economy. And if you're a business traveler, you need to use up all your time. So the idea is you fly in the evening and have a full day of business the next day. So probably most business travelers aren't willing to sit in a plane during the day, but they're willing to sleep on a flight during the day, obviously provided they're flying business class. So I think that's what drives it.
Well, maybe someone should redo their thoughts, because if you've got internet connectivity, as you now have, you can work during the day as well. So anyway, I'm sure these guys have been turning us around in their heads to see where the best advantage could be, because that's the one thing we do know about the airline industry. It's highly, highly competitive, and I guess likely to remain so in South Africa.
Yes, it's not great now that one airline is dominant, but it will change.
Glenn Osmond, good talking with you. Thanks for those insights into Crash and Burn. We haven't really touched on a lot of the controversial stuff, a lot of the insightful stuff, the board meeting where Brian Joffe came in at Comair and had an impact there. The Novick family disappeared, the departure of One Time and your successor there and the disasters that they wrought and many others. But I think that's only fair. I don't like to see authors spilling their all. Leave something in the tank, and there's plenty in the tank on this book, Crash and Burn. I strongly recommend it. I did find it, as I mentioned earlier, riveting, fascinating read. Read a lot of books, and this is one of the better ones. Thanks, Glenn, for your time today. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.